Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Griffin.
It's sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi there, Mark Kenny here from ANU's Australian Studies Institute with another Democracy Sausage episode. And this week, I want to bring you something a bit different. Rethinking Social Media and Extremism is a new book from ANU Press, launched just a couple of days ago by ANU Vice-Chancellor Brian Schmidt. It followed a brilliant symposium held at ANU, which brought together scholars in a range of disciplines to discuss social media and how it changes the way we understand the world, how we socialise and even organise, and how it can be used for colossal wrongdoing as well. I'm thrilled to have two of the editors of the book, the two editors of the book indeed, with me this week to tease out some of the arguments it canvasses. Professor Shirley Leach is Professor Emerita at the Australian Studies Institute, and Paul Pickering is the founding director of the Australian Studies Institute. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Mark. Great pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Mark.
Let me also welcome Dr. Katrina Grant. Dr. Grant is senior lecturer in the Centre for Digital Humanities Research, and her engaging essay in this collection is titled Performance of Power, the Site of Public Debate. Welcome to you too, Katrina.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Mark.
I've long wanted to get you onto the podcast, and now we have a very credible reason for doing so. Shirley, I'll start with you. The impetus for the symposium that I mentioned, which of course then informed the range of chapters or essays that we have in this book, the impetus for that was the appalling events in Christchurch in 2019. Can you just take us through, just take us back to then and why that? Because you were sort of one of the key reasons this symposium happened. Just talk us through the sort of reasoning in your mind about that and why social media was such a focus.
What was different and special and tragic, especially tragic about Christchurch, was the fact that social media was absolutely at the heart of this whole event. Social media was implicated in the radicalisation of the terrorist. It was implicated in the networks that he formed on social media through Facebook, but as well as on the dark web through 8chan and so forth. Just before he went and shot 51 men, women and children, he invited his friends to join him on Facebook, and then he proceeded to live stream the entire massacre, framing it as a first-person shooter game. And it went out uninterrupted, and not one person complained to Facebook. Facebook itself didn't appear to be aware that it was happening, and it was subsequently shared millions of times on the internet. So I think it was especially horrific because it was brought to you courtesy of the same social media platform that on which you share your holiday snaps and your diet tips and your what I've just read recommendations, and it sparked an international outcry. It led to the Christchurch call, which was one of the first international agreements about trying to control violent extremist content online. It was also extraordinary because there was a marked difference in the response from the US. Now, the US has special legislation that has actually protected social media companies from any liability for their content. They are the largest publishers of news and various other forms of content now, but they have actually been defined not as publishers. And so while your local newspaper might be very well controlled and regulated, something as enormous as Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and so forth, they have actually escaped a lot of those same controls and liabilities. And there is quite a lot of growing evidence now that there's no justification for this and that it has actually led to a very sort of parlous situation that we now all find ourselves in globally.
Yeah, this is the argument that these social media behemoths have run for, you know, since they've been around. And they are a relatively recent phenomenon. But that argument that they are essentially platforms, they're spaces for people to and groups to publish and exchange, to communicate with each other, but the companies themselves don't have any responsibility for the content. But that's a pretty extraordinary claim to make when you see the appalling implications of some of that content, and this was a graphic example of it. And of course, there have been many others.
There certainly have. I mean, I think one of the other aspects that you can't forget is actually how the profitability of these companies has actually been underpinned by their lack of legal responsibility or liability. And another dimension also of the whole unfolding crisis in terms of violent extremism online has been the threats that these companies actually face, particularly under the Trump administration, but it has continued with the conservative voices in the US Congress. But every time the companies have looked like they're going to control content, particularly from the far right and from what they would call the alt-right or conservative groups, that they have been threatened with antitrust suits. In other words, their entire business model has come under threat. Their profitability has come under threat every time it's looked like they've been about to take action.
Paul, what's the sort of overall philosophy of the book, though? Because the it's not just about Christchurch, is it? There are chapters that I guess use that as the sort of jumping off point for considering a whole range of issues, as Shirley's just been saying, that are thrown up by that appalling event, but also by others. And in fact, you take even a very sort of historical, you are a historian by training, but you take a very much a historical lens to it. I wonder if you could just give us a sort of an outline of the overall structure of the book and perhaps then go to why you think we need to remember the history here.
Thanks, Mark. When Shirley first came to us with the idea of a symposium on this issue, it seemed perfect for the dreadful circumstances that we were looking at from Christchurch. And our aim was to bring together a range, as broad a range as we could, of interdisciplinary scholars. So the book is, I think, a reflection of that. And we're very pleased that we can bring together philosophers, economists, people from media studies, people from digital humanities, historians, to all focus on the same set of issues, to in a sense try and create momentum for thinking about these issues in a more holistic way. And I think Shirley and I can be proud of the authors in that they've embraced that challenge. And I think we've ended up with a good read. In relation to my chapter that's co-written with Terry Nermico-Fuller, as an internal polemic. We try and, in a sense, start from the beginning and finish at the contemporary point, or the point at which we currently are in terms of the debate. I think it's a lively polemic, and Thierry would say I'm wrong, and I would say she's wrong.
Yes, that's right. So you've taken a kind of there's a dialogue in that chapter of the book, and you've called it Crisis, What Crisis, which sort of suggests at least that there's an argument being put the problem that people are diagnosing may not be perhaps as open or as black and white as some people think it is, or indeed is as novel.
I guess the term crisis, what crisis, comes from a tabloid newspaper in the UK from 1979.
Is that when it was first used?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then it was borrowed by the band Supertramp as a title for an album as well. But what it's designed to underline, I think Terry and I agreed, was the sense in which this is not the first crisis, and that, in a sense, innovations in technology have always produced a sense of crisis. And our argument is between us whether, in fact, internet technology is unlike any other crisis, that we've, in a sense, that we've come to a new form of crisis, which is unlike any of the previous.
Katrina, where do you stand on that question? It's a big one, isn't it? Because yes, you can talk about the invention of writing on tablets. You can talk about the invention of the printing press. Eventually, books, newspapers, which are sort of very much mass media, broadcasting in particular, radio, then television. But all of these things are, in a sense, in the hands of the elites, right? They are very, very, very significant in terms of the amount of information that can be pumped out and kind of universalized, understandings of historical events, contemporaneous events, and the like. But nonetheless, they are controlled, curated by capital, by people who have power, or by governments. The internet is of a different order, isn't it? There's a different character, particularly going back to what Shirley was saying about, this sort of whole thing about platforms, but it's hyper-democratic.
Mm. It is. I mean, in a way, I feel a bit as a historian who is also a digital humanities researcher, that I have this polemic that Paul and Terhi wrote about in my own head, because on the one hand, as a historian, you think, these things have happened before. This is not the first time the world has been in crisis, and there have been worse crises that we've confronted. But also you look at it, and you, as someone who works online, who spends a lot of time online, both as a researcher and as a individual, I grew up high school in the 90s, and the internet emerged. It emerged while I was doing my undergraduate study, and it did change everything. And there was this sense that, I think, what was so alluring about social media in its early forms on forums, which I guess was one of the first ways you encountered this ability to reach out to other people, and then on Twitter, was this sense that you could just reach all sorts of people, that this idea of the filter bubble, almost, it wasn't there early on. There wasn't this sense that you were just talking to like-minded people, even though maybe you were self-selecting and self-selecting who you followed and who you listened to. But it was this sense that you could get online and find special interest groups. And I remember setting up a support group for people doing PhDs in 2005. And it was like having a water cooler when you were stuck at your own desk at home. And so it is really different. Like, you didn't get that through books. You didn't get that through magazines. You could send your letters into the editor, but the editor got to decide whether you talked to everyone, whereas now you get to decide. Everyone else gets to decide whether they listen to you or not. But
there's a big generational divide in some of these interpretations, though, I think. I mean, not exclusively, because there are certainly people who are fully fledged adults long before the internet came around, and who are absolutely dedicated to it and conversant with it in all kinds of expert ways. But as a generalization, there are a lot of people who now have grown up with it and who are very very adept at using it, very strong supporters of the concept of the internet. And then there are others who have perhaps seen both worlds, the pre-digital and the post-digital world, and have some criticisms of it, have some concerns about the corrosive effect of, say, misinformation, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who have grown up with it have those concerns as well. They observe those things happening. Perhaps, I mean, one of the differences, and I was thinking about this yesterday, talking to a group of students about sort of art online and digital art and that world, is that sense of, you know, there isn't any difference anymore. It's like there isn't this distinction between things you do in real life, IRL, and the things that you do online. That it's all part of our lives. We carry around smartphones and we can switch between having a conversation in person and, you know, right now we're sitting in a studio and some of us are here in person and some of us are joining online. There isn't that distinction.
It's
sort
of going so well as well, isn't it? We've had no technical problems.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's amazing. The internet is wonderful. So I think that's perhaps part of the shift that needs to happen, is not saying you can't just blame the internet, but you also have to observe the role that the internet plays, the way that it changes the dynamics, the access that it gives people. You can't just sort of say, oh, well, if we just take it away from them, then that will sort out. You know, the alt-right will go away if we shut off the internet. And apart from the ridiculousness of the idea of shutting off the internet, it won't. Mm. It won't. But so you have to sort of balance those two things. The internet didn't necessarily make all these things happen, but it's made some of them happen.
Yeah, or at least facilitated them. Yeah. Let's just take a very quick break and be back in a moment.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, before the break, Katrina was just talking about, I suppose, you know, the fact that we have the internet and there are going to be complaints about it, but we can't, it's completely fanciful to consider a world without it now. And there are many, many benefits, of course, countless benefits that we see in our lives. Shirley, I wonder where you sort of stand in this debate, because I guess it's fair to say that of the four of us here, you, Paul, and I are very much kind of, you know, pre-internet people. Prehistoric, perhaps, even.
Thanks for that, Mark.
Yeah. I'm the youngest of us, so I'm you know, I'm going to take that small prize. But, Shirley, I just wonder, that question about, you know, the net good or the net good of the net, if I can put it like that, it's obviously a great positive, but there are concerns. And there are, as we've discussed, the impetus for this book was the Christchurch massacre. And there have been things since that we know of, the January 6 insurrection and how the internet and social media and other platforms, end-to-end encryption and so forth, were used in all of that. This presents an enormous sort of regulation problem, but also a sort of a socialization problem, I'd argue. How do we address it? The nation states, you know, sort of somewhat powerless against these massive supranational corporations?
The internet is all of the previous forms of communication on steroids. And if you think about it, it's aggregated them all up. So it is television, it is radio, it is newspapers, it is a photo album, it is chatting to your neighbour over the fence. It is all of these forms of communication all at once. It's broadcasting, it's narrowcasting, it's something we have never seen before. And the legal frameworks that we had in place were simply completely inadequate. Now, you couple that with the speed with which the internet exploded into the world. I mean, from, you know, it started as this sort of nerdy thing that, you know, a few scientists put up to communicate with one another. And now it's something that everybody carries around on devices or on their wrists. It has simply been impossible for democracies or even autocracies to keep up with the pace of change of the internet. I mean, initially there was a huge amount of criticism, for example, of countries that actually tried to regulate the internet on the basis that this was anti-democratic. And now, of course, democracies are suddenly realizing that an unregulated internet is also profoundly anti-democratic and a threat to democracy itself. I go to Paul's and Turhi's chapter, Crisis, What Crisis? Paul is absolutely right. There is always a call from elites to damp down the voices of the people, to actually control forms of communication. Turhi is also right that the internet is fundamentally different to every other form of communication technology that we have ever seen. And I think it's going to take another decade until we can even get close to understanding what it is and to figuring out how we're actually going to live with it. That's kind of a positive reading too, because I'm the ever optimistic person who actually believes this will happen. But we are going to see more and more ugly events occurring, which are facilitated by the internet and particularly by social media, until that happens.
So, I mean, if I might jump in there, Mark, I think there are three points to make in response to that. Obviously, I agree with Shirley and with Terry, and with the all the authors in the book that this is something different. But I think there are three points that really need to be thought about. One is how this gets entangled with the right to free speech. Two, the overwhelming naivety of the people who began to use the internet for political purposes. This was seen was called monitory democracy, the way that people could actually keep the state under control through use of smartphones and so forth. And it was so naive to think that the right or the alt-right weren't also going to be able to use it for political purposes. And I guess my fundamental point is, by the time we catch up with the internet, if we ever can, what's next? What is going to seem like the next crisis where this one will sort of pale into significance? And I think if you look at the historical narratives, the same sorts of things are being said about printing, about radio, about television, that this opens up new possibilities for politics and everything has changed and nothing will ever be the same. So what's next?
It's a really good question, because we don't know. But what we can say is that this has all happened really, really quickly. As you said, Katrina, sort of in the mid-90s, you kind of feel it happen essentially in real time. And that's a very short time frame for such a dramatic transformation of the way information flows around the world. And we know about all of these, the ways in which social media has been used. Misinformation, of course, is a whole thing now. It's a whole force that that governments are dealing with, that populations are dealing with. It's weaponized. It's used to roll governments, to delegitimize governments, to spark movements, and used mendaciously. It is misinformation, after all. Donald Trump's presidency was floated on it, and left in a flurry of misinformation. And of course, there's been plenty of it around, even as we record this in recent days, around the FBI raids on Mar-a-Lago, his Florida mansion. So, I mean, as Paul says, we can ask what next, but what's your view about it? Is there a threat to democracy itself, or perhaps put it another way, is it likely from where we sit at the moment that digital ways of doing things, including in the transaction of democracy, the relationship between people and their governments, will come to overwhelm the pre-digital forms, elections and so forth?
Hmm. I think, on the second point, they sort of have already. There is already a turn to the use of social media as a way of running all campaigns. We saw it in the recent Australian election that the independents used social media more than they used a lot of the traditional forms of media. And so, and I think in a way, I guess on that point, that sort of gives us that insight that it's not going to overwhelm democracy. It can be used as a tool to support democracy and to undermine democracy. That's what's so difficult about it.
But I mean, it strikes me that when we say democracy, and that was probably my fault, we should really be saying representative democracy, right?
Yeah.
Because that's always worked on the basis that we have representatives who are collating enough information about an issue and in how it relates to their community to do that representation and do so reasonably faithfully. But the digital world gives us the opportunity for a much more direct relationship between what people want, almost on a daily basis. I mean, what was logistically impossible before is now possible. That is, to basically be having citizen referenda on everything.
Mm-hmm.
The digital world presents that possibility. Why do you need parliaments, for example?
Great. Why do we? We'll just move it on Twitter. That'll be fine. But I mean, one of the things is, in a way, I guess, and I would say this because I guess I am a lecturer and one of the things I do is teach, but education is part of this, is there was a whole myth that we dealt with about the digital native, which still has a lot of currency, this idea that people who grew up with certain types of technology, with the net, are therefore have a level of expertise. But it's wrong. It's like one of the reasons that technology has become so pervasive is because it's been designed to be easy to use. You know, it's designed to be addictive as well. Smartphones, apps are all designed to kind of trigger our brains to work in certain ways. It's very hard to put down. We've all experienced that sense of anxiety of being separated from a device. And so, like, I admit to it, I'm conscious of why it happens, but it's hard. And so part of it is this, we need to educate people to understand what they're giving up when they click, I've read the terms and conditions, and they haven't read the terms and conditions, which I do. We need to educate people to think about, you know, if you become a follower of Donald Trump on Twitter in 2015 because you think it's quite funny that this guy is running for president and he seems like a bit of a buffoon and it's this sort of, you know, series of, entertaining spectacles unfolding, you're essentially sitting down and giving him an audience. You're expanding the reach of a person like that. And so it needs to be, you need to make educated choices about.
I like to think I was fairly impervious to Kavefi and everything.
Those moves seem funny, but they're deliberate.
I'm not sure Kavefi was.
But the way he responds to it is deliberate. Yeah. It's like, well, he doesn't delete it. He lets it go. Mm. He lets it spread out. People, he gets what he wants. People are talking about him. It doesn't matter if they're saying he's a fool or trying to decipher his weird, you know, posts. And that's part of the difference between, you know, 30 years ago, if he went on TV and acted like an absolute buffoon as someone in power, there would potentially have been more ramifications. You would have been laughed off the screen. You might not have been invited back. You don't know about. Well, yeah, I will. I think it's hand over to your wisdom.
I think it's an interesting point, Paul. Because going back to the point about those the pre-digital period, that being mediated, that being controlled by elites, by journalists and newspapers and television stations and so forth. So our politics was less raw in that sense. Our relationship with it was less raw. I suspect what Katrina's saying there is probably right, that a lot of the stuff that Trump was able to get away with and other demagogues have modelled as well, it reaches enough people now in ways that are completely unfiltered. I mean, what did you think about what we had with Donald Trump? We had access to his midnight mind, which was an unpretty thing, but nonetheless, we had a sort of direct, unfiltered access to the president, to his thinking, even more so than his chief of staff or his advisors, let alone editors or political correspondents or the various processes through which information and messaging used to flow. I mean, a lot of the things that Trump said, he would have been counseled away from saying, just about everything really, would have been counseled away from saying by advisors in the past. And politics wasn't raw in that sense. Now, at one level, you could say, Paul, that's so now it's much more democratic, much more honest, you know, there's less artifice involved. But at another level, you don't need to win more than half the electorate, not much more anyway. You just need to win half of it. And that's what Trump essentially did.
Who speaks for those people who voted for him? I mean, the leaders of the last decade who've spoken out against censorship of the internet are Barack Obama and Angela Merkel.
Hmm.
These have been the two poles of the hope for democracy. They can't ultimately see that it's going to be a good thing. And so I think we need to think carefully. 70-odd million people voted for Donald Trump. Who's going to speak for them and who's going to decide what gets censored off the internet and on what basis? These are questions which I don't know the answers to, but they're questions that we need to discuss.
Shirley, I'm hoping you've got the answer to that because, you've taken the helicopter view here. I mean, in a sense, that is one of the questions, but it's also a kind of a rhetorical question because no one's really suggesting that we are going to be able to go back to a pre-digital way of transacting our politics or our public debate. So the answer has to lie somewhere in between, doesn't it, with as light a touch regulation as is possible, coupled with perhaps, as I've tried to argue before, perhaps some level of, I don't know, some establishment of some level of kind of mores of social standards in the digital space, or is that just pie in the sky?
Look, I think it depends what question you ask. If you're talking about somehow controlling the speech of, 70 million people, that's one thing. If you're talking about, exercising some degree of control over groups like the Proud Boys, who are extreme armed militia, who have already shown their willingness to launch an armed attack on the US Capitol building, that's quite a different thing. One is a violent extremist, rhetoric accompanied with evidence of violent action. The other is shooting the breeze on social media. They're not the same thing. And I actually think that conflating them is an argument that is used by extremist groups in order to try to protect their own activity. So I think, it depends what question you ask, what answer you come up with.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Katrina, we're getting close to time, but I thought I might just sort of put this to you because your chapter was, as I said, it was called The Performance of Power, The Sight of Public Debate. And it occurred to me reading it that one of the things that we've done, and this is quite understandable, one of the things we've done as the internet came about, as these social media platforms emerged into our lives, is that a lot of things in the digital space were sort of explained with by physical analogies so that we could understand essentially what these digital concepts were. And, of course, one of them that's very pervasive is the idea of social media as being like the town square. Can you talk to that, to the strengths and weaknesses of that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting metaphor. I think when I was thinking about what to write in the chapter, I saw people tweeting about, but you can't, I can't even remember quite at the time what the crisis was, but, you know, you can't ban someone from this because you can't ban them from the town square. That's, you know, undemocratic. And I thought, well, there's plenty of examples in the past of civic spaces from which people are often banned or that are reserved for certain purposes. And so I thought it's interesting as a historian to examine that history. And in a way, what I was interested in was not so much that long history of how different types of meeting spaces, civic spaces have been used, like the Agora in Athens or the Forum in Rome or sort of public squares in early modern cities, but was to think about the way that we idealize this, the way that we say if we can just have a civic square in the city that will bring democracy to the people who exist there. And it's a really, it is perhaps true to an extent. It's, and you need to have those spaces where people can come together, where they can see each other as a population. I think I quoted.
But that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because that's where, for me, that's where the metaphor falls down really quite dramatically is that you can't see each other in the digital space. And a lot of people rely on anonymity. As anyone who has a Twitter following knows, it's rife with people who hide behind anonymity. And there are lots of people who defend anonymity too. I'm not one of them, I might say, but there are lots of people who do. And I think they have, you know, there are some good prima facie arguments for it in terms of, you know, public servants or people who would otherwise come in for some level of discrimination if they revealed themselves. But nonetheless, it's a wild west and, you know, there's a lot of vituperation and abuse and so forth that goes on there. That doesn't happen. I mean, you can go into the town square and you can start screaming at whoever's talking at the time, but you won't last very long and your face will be seen. You'll be accountable for that behavior in some way. There will be some social sanction. The internet doesn't carry any of that.
And it's one of the things that's different about the web, I think. I mean, you say you can't get away with it for long, but we had those, the convoy to Canberra seemed to hang around in Canberra for quite a long time.
They were hanging around with each other. I mean,
with each other, but they were present in our spaces. In a way, but I do see it is one of the things that's changed about the web. And it's changed over the period of the web becoming part of our social lives, as opposed to just going into it to retrieve information. That when, you know, when I remember being taught this as a high school student in the mid 90s, it was like, never reveal who you are online. You know, make sure that your email address is not your real name. Make sure that you never use your real name. You never reveal anything about yourself. And then that's completely shifted to the point where, as you say, and quite rightly in many cases, anonymity is treated with suspicion. Facebook brought in rules, I can't remember how long ago, maybe even 10 years ago, to say you can't use a pseudonym. You were meant to use your real name. Obviously not everyone does, but there was this push to have people reveal who they really were online. And there's a division. We see it on Twitter. You probably see a lot more of it as someone with a bigger Twitter following than I have, that if you have anonymous people replying to you, you think, oh, here we go. Like, this is why are they anonymous? And whereas it's a real name, you tend to think, well, okay, I'll give this person some time. But it's tricky. It's a tricky thing because anonymity can be a fantastic thing. It can be a good protection for people who are under threat from hate speech and are under threat from violence, but it can also be used for the people who want to do that.
I buy that to an extent. I just think it's an argument that is somewhat overcooked because numerically the number of people who are on, you know, the number of people who are on things like Twitter and who rely on anonymity to then just fire off abuse at people and the whole sort of collapse of civility in that space as a result of that, the whole tone of it can be pretty bloody alienating. and distressing. And I know plenty of my former colleagues in journalism who literally have just left it because they are attacked mercilessly and, you know, personally for it. And I just think, oh, really, that's pretty uncivilized. Look, we're out of time. We could talk about this for a long time, and I'd love to be able to do that, but I can strongly recommend the book. I'm going to very quickly just go through the authors here because we couldn't have all of the authors in the studio, of course, but the aforementioned Shirley Leach and Paul Pickering, of course, are the editors. They also are contributors to the book. Also, Professor Sally Wheeler, Robert Fleet, Andrew Hughes, Mark Nolan and Dominique Della Pozza. Katrina Grant, as you're here, Katrina, Te Hinamiko Fuller, along with Paul Pickering, of course. So there's plenty to read here. There are lots of different angles that are treated in this book. And the good thing for you, if you're listening on the internet, by definition, as you will be for this podcast, is that you can also access this book. You can download it for free. So it's available from ANU Press. We'll put the link on the notification about this podcast, and you'll be able to access it there, and you can fire off whatever abuse you feel inclined to. No, you can learn from that that process and hopefully start some further discussions and debate. So thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Shirley.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
And thank you, Katrina.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, all of you, for your time today. I hope that's been enjoyable, as it has been for me. And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. See you again next week. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.